The book of Matthew, which means, of course, we have to start where? Isaiah chapter 7. We have entitled this whole series in the Gospel of Matthew, Finding the Messiah. Let's find out who Messiah is. Chapter 7, book of Isaiah, look down there to verse number 14. Isaiah writing 700 years before Jesus was born. Look what he says. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, check it out, look out for, be on vigil, search, expect something special. The virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. And you guys know what that means, right? God with us. A couple chapters to the right, chapter 9, verse 6. For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. This child is going to rule and reign the entire planet. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty, what? Mighty God. Who is the baby born in the manger in Bethlehem, you guys? He is fully God. We're not done. There's a comma, which means there's more coming. Everlasting what? Father. He is the mighty God, the everlasting Father, and the Prince of Peace. And that word Messiah, it really means the anointed one. Your New Testament was written in Greek originally, and then we read English translations of those Greek texts. How do you say Messiah in Greek? You say Christos. I used to think that Christ was Jesus' last name, born to Mr. and Mrs. Christ, their son Jesus. Until somebody goes, well, no, not really, that's a title. Who is the Christos? The mighty God, the everlasting Father. Are we clear about who Messiah is? Now, Matthew chapter 1. Matthew is what everybody called him. That was his first name, but he had a surname. That's like your family name. My name is Steve, first name, last name, Hadley. Hadley is my surname, it's my family name. Matthew is his first name, but his surname or given family name is Levi. Of the 12 tribes of Israel, which tribe only was allowed to be privileged to be the priests of the temple and the tabernacle? And it's not a stretch to understand that his family were Levitical priests. We'll see in chapter 9 of Matthew and also chapter 2 of Mark that he was a tax collector. Let me tell you a little bit about that. Now imagine if some foreign nation attacked and was successful in a bloody, long military campaign and finally was occupying the United States. How many of you would have a little trouble with that? The Romans in 70 AD, they're going to destroy the whole temple. They're going to lay siege to Jerusalem, and over 1.5 million Jews will perish. The iron sandal of Rome is squarely on the neck, as it were, of the people of Israel. What did they think about this occupying force? They didn't like it at all. Well, how did Rome raise money? They would pronounce exorbitant taxes on the people. So here's what the job was of Matthew. First of all, he's working for the Romans. Imagine in our society, let's call them the Russians for now. So you have Russian governors who have kicked out all of the people in the fine mansions of Washoe County or Reno Sparks, and they're living sumptuously off of squeezing you for your taxes. So then you have to pay these Russians, but the Russians didn't want to get out and among the people because they had their parties and their Roman sort of observances to take care of. What they would do is they would hire local Jewish guys to sit in the tax booth to collect the taxes. So let's say, for instance, Rick, of course, who is a nice guy, but he's now working for the Russians. So I'm cruising down Audi Boulevard, and I get stopped. Stop! And I have to pull into Rick's tax stand. Good morning, Steve, he says to me. Good morning, Rick, you traitor. Now, there was an expected tax, and it was typically posted throughout the region. So I had to pay that tax. Well, how would Rick make his living? He would squeeze me for a little bit more, and that's what he lived on. He lived on the misery of squeezing his own countrymen to pay taxes to Rome and to line his pockets. After the Roman mansions, who were the biggest houses in town, you guys? They were fellow countrymen, turncoats, traitors of the highest order. What do you think the people, the Jewish people, thought when they saw a Jewish tax collector walking by? They hated them with a white hot passion. Matthew, surnamed Levi, was not only a turncoat Jewish man, he was one who had walked away from his Levitical priest heritage. This guy was in tough shape. The only people of his culture who would even dare to hang around him were other tax collectors and prostitutes, as we'll see later on in the story. He is a factual person of history. He's not a literary device of any kind. He really did exist. He really did live. And if he's a real feeling human being, I think it wouldn't be tough for us to put that on for a moment. Like all of us, he had to click off the light or turn down the lamp, as it were, and in the quietness of his own thoughts, had to wrestle, I believe, a cultural struggle, an inner struggle. When the alcohol's effects were minimal and he was alone, I wonder if a little part of him whispered, Matthew, what are you doing? You weren't made for this. You were made with a purpose and a plan. You, Matthew, are ignoring every prompting, every heritage, every family. You grew up in the temple watching your father and your grandfather and your uncles minister to the living God. Now, what are you doing? I wonder. Though his sinful life was large and loud and totally consuming, I believe he knew he had a deeper calling. I believe he knew that he had been created for a larger purpose. I believe he knew he had been created for such a time as this. What do you mean this? Also, what's happening at this time, too, there were many people that were saying, hey, have you been checking out Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel? Have you noticed that the times are ripe for the Messiah? There were many people that were saying, hey, I'm looking at these prophecies here, and something is going to happen soon. And then, don't forget, John the Baptist popped up. And he's down south of the area of Jerusalem, and in the Jordan River, he is baptizing people. He is saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. The whole nation of Israel was abuzz with the crackling expectation that Messiah was near. He knows his Bible. He was raised with it. He knows about God's prophecies. He knows that not just anybody can claim to be Messiah. There's a rigorous set of prophecies. In Matthew, you're going to see 129 direct Old Testament quotes. He knew his Bible. I have found the Messiah, and I'm going to prove it to you. 14 times, that which was spoken in the Old Testament. 32 times, kingdom of heaven. If you like outlines, if you're taking notes, we're going to watch for five main sections in the book of Matthew. Each one is consisting of a teaching, a discourse. The discourse would often be followed by a really cool example of Jesus' fruit and his God-given authority, Messiah stuff. And then what would the religious people do? We're not buying it. This young, self-proclaimed rabbi from backwaters Nazareth. So there'll be a debate usually. By the way, too, Matthew was accustomed to taking quick notes. His whole job was basically to keep everybody's taxes and what they paid and what they owed straight. There was a form of Hebrew and even Greek shorthand. God says, I'm going to choose you, Matthew, first of all, because I'm moving in your life. But secondly, I'm going to use what's in your hand. God loves to do that, you guys. When God taps you, when he calls you, he basically says, I want to use you. We're the ones who say, what can you use, Lord? What did God say to Moses at the burning bush? What's in your hand? Oh, this staff? Oh, I'm just used to riding sheep around. Surely that won't pertain to my ministry. King David, as a preteen perhaps. David, what's in your hand? A sling. Peter, what's in your hand? A net. He'd be a fisher of men. What was in Matthew's hand? It was a pen. That's why in the Gospel of Matthew, you're going to see tremendously accurate, verbatim recording of what Jesus said, because he excelled in this sort of shorthand that went on with it. Chapters 1 through 10, to borrow from John Corson, the Messiah revealed. Chapters 11 through 13, Messiah resisted. Chapters 14 through 20, the Messiah retreating for some very important reasons. Chapters 21 through 27, Messiah rejected. And chapter 28, the Messiah or the King resurrected. Are you ready for Messiah, the King revealed? Here we go. Chapter 1, verse 1. Yeah, okay, one more little side note there. Chapter 1, the first 11 verses, is what's called the genealogies. How many of you think that's chloroform in print? Every dotting of the I, every crossing of the T in God's word means something. First of all, this genealogy is important because in the year 70 AD, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. And with it, all records of lineages. And if Jesus is going to be declared king, shouldn't his pedigree be undeniable? After 70 AD, for someone to jump up and claim that I'm Messiah, how in the world could they possibly verify that they are, number one, a direct descendant of Abraham and a direct descendant of King David? Since 70 AD, you can't do that. So here's the genealogy for that respect. But I want to show you one more thing. A geek alert. Watch out. We're going to be reading a bunch of names here in just a minute. Get your computer, a big cup of coffee, a calculator perhaps. I want you to make a list of names, but I'm going to give you some criteria. Would you make up any words or names that you want? But when you're done with your genealogy, make certain that the number of words in the list are divisible equally by 7. No remainders. Okay? Number 2. When you're done with your list of genealogies, make sure that the number of letters that you use are exactly divisible by 7. No remainder. Number 3. When you're done with your list, use any names that you want, any even makeup names if you like. But when you're done, the words and the letters must be divisible by 7, and the vowels. Use as many A-E-I-O-U's as you'd like, but when you're done, they have to be divisible by 7. Is this list getting tougher and tougher? We're not done yet. Number 4. Beans, we did the vowels. Let's do all the consonants as well. Use as many consonants as you want, but when you're done, they have to be divisible by 7. By the way, is the number 7 an interesting number in the scriptures? It sure is. Numbers in the Bible are, I believe, the fingerprint of the architect of our creation. 7 is God's number of completion. How many continents on the planet, you guys? How many of the seas? The 7 seas. In music, a do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Do, there's your octave. How many notes are there in a scale? How many visible bands of color in the typical rainbow? How many days in the week? 7 is the number of God's completion. And there was a fella by the name of Dr. Ivan Panin. He was born in Russia, December the 12th, 1855. He died here in America in October of 1942. About the middle of the 1800s, the Tsar, Tsar Nicholas III et al., they were making it really tough on the working class people. They weren't technically slaves, but because they were paid so dismally, you might as well be slaves. And so the rich were getting richer, and then the middle class was very thin, and then the majority of the working class bore the brunt of that nation. Here is Ivan Panin as an 18-year-old young man. He goes to the factories and he teaches people how to read and write, how to do mathematics and basic educational tools. And for his trouble, he got hunted. So he leaves and he moves to Germany, and then eventually he moves to America. And he joined in a little school there on the East Coast by the name of Harvard. And there he mows through several degrees. He's a self-avowed agnostic. And he was so intelligent, his writings and musings were distributed in a syndicated fashion through some of the newspapers in that region of the United States. And he was invited one time to critique with that keen intellect the Bible itself. He got stuck on something. Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In his pastimes, he thought it might be kind of fun to take some Greek and Hebrew. So he says, wait a minute, we're missing a definite article here. In the beginning was the Word, that's good. And the Word was with God, and the Word was a or for or some other definite article. The Word can't be God, come on. So he began to study in the original Greek. He found out that the rabbis in the Old Testament noticed that these heptaphs, these groupings of sevens, were all over the place. Not a mathematician by training, but a mathematician by hobby. He said the statistical probability that these would happen by themselves are just... It was Dr. Ivan Panin who gave this list that we are reading. Where do we leave off at? Consonants. Number 5. Every word that begins with a vowel, divisible by 7. And while we're at it, the number of words that begin with a consonant, divisible by 7. The number of words that occur more than one time. You can use duplicate words, go ahead. But when you're done, they have to be divisible by 7. The number of words that occur in more than one form. We have verbs and we have adverbs, and a single word can sometimes function in two capacities. Use as many of those as you want. But when you're done, what? Divisible by seven. The number of words that occur in only one form, divisible by seven. How about the number of nouns? Go ahead, use as many nouns as you want, divisible by seven. Only seven words will not be nouns. How difficult would this be for you to pull out any names that you wanted and still hold to these criteria? We're not done. How about number 12? The number of names you use, divisible by seven. The number of male names that you use, divisible by seven. Oh, and let's try one more. Use as many generations as you want in your genealogy, but when you're done, they have to be divisible by seven. How difficult would that be? And you get to pick and choose any name that you want. Would this be hard? Let's turn that around a little bit. You're walking down the sidewalk and papers are rustling because of the breeze. You happen to stoop down and pick up one, and you notice a genealogy. You notice that the genealogy written on this piece of paper fulfills all 14 of those criteria. Would it be a natural assumption to say, this didn't just happen by accident? This is somebody working really hard. How many of you would arrive at that? And here's our punchline, by the way. In the original Greek, in the first 11 verses of the book of Matthew. The first 11 verses also contain 72 words. Is that divisible by seven? In Greek and in Hebrew, those are very ancient languages, and they didn't have cardinal numbers like we have. 1, 2, 3. Those cardinal numbers don't happen until later. So many of the ancient languages had corresponding numerical values. The sum of all 72 words in the first 11 verses is 42,364, or 7 times 6,052. If one criteria by accident of these 14, 1 in 50. If 5, 1 in 17,000. How about if you hit 8 of them? Just 8. That's 1 in 5,764,801. What about all 14? Glad you asked. That would be 1 in 40 million. These names in Matthew chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, they're not pulled out of the air, are they? They are real people who really lived. Do you see how God is in control of this Bible? Chapter 1 now, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Matthew is going to point out, let me show you his royal lineage. Verse 2. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot Judah and his brothers. Judah begot Perez and Zerah by Tamar. I'd like you to circle that if you would. You're going to notice that in this genealogy, there are going to be 5 women. Now, most royal backgrounds, nobody ever mentions the woman. This genealogy does, and there's some real important reasons for that. But for now, we'll just circle Tamar.